And we're holding on an Aleph Amud Aleph second line. Continuing on the topic of we were discussing when a person has passed away and his children inherit his property. So we said that there is a in the usual case where there are both boys and girls. So the boys yarshin the property. The girls are entitled to mizonos, to ongoing support until they become begeres or until they marry, whichever is first. So we were talking about the question of are they entitled to collect for that even out of metaltlin, or we said, according to most opinions, we said only out of karka, only out of the land that their father had left behind. So now further on that, and we also drew a possible distinction between that, we also talked about there's mizonos and then there's also parnosa, where parnosa is what's given towards the girls in the dunya, towards her naden or dowry and whatever other wedding expenses. So is there a difference in that regard? So the Gemara continues. Ahu yosim v'yisoma da'osu v'kamei d'rab. A boy and a girl, both orphans, came to Rav. So now they both being children, then their nechasim were being administered by an apotropos. So they're coming to say that they need the apotropos to release some funds for them for their purposes. Omalahu Rav, how lo yosim b'shvil yisoma. So Rava says what you should do is give the yosim extra mizonos, extra money for mizonos, and his sister will be able to be will be able to be supported with that extra. In other words, Rava is saying that we're going to take now for the yosim himself. We can take from the Taltlin. It is ultimately his property. The apotropos is just taking care of it for him. So therefore, Rava is saying for the yosim himself, we're taking out for both karka and the Taltlin, whichever is more easily available. And therefore, in this case, you're going to be selling off some extra in order to be able to feed the sister as well. Amri le rabbanon le Rava, but the other chachamim said to Rava, how could you do that? Didn't you yourself say, which we have later in the Masechta, that you can collect only from karka, not from the taltlin, for any of the things that are collected from the yesomim's property, whether it's mizonos, whether it's food and maintenance for the girls, whether to pay off the actual ksuba. Even though when the husband is alive, the tsuba is payable. So when the husband is alive, the tsuba is payable in principle only from karka, but in practice they often put a clause in there saying that's on his metaltlin as well. But after he passes away, we can only collect from karka of yisaimim, not from the metaltlin, or bein la parnasa, or whether it applies to wedding expenses for the daughters. So, but over here you're saying that you combine the expenses for the yosim and the yosoma, implying that just as for the yosim you take out from the taltlin, so it is for the girl. Why is that? So Rava answers them, it's logical. Suppose that this yosim didn't have a sister, but suppose that he wanted a maid servant to help him around the house, to clean and cook and whatever. Wouldn't we give him? That would be considered a valid expense, and the apotropos would be responsible as the guardian of the yosim and of his property to go and take some money and use that to buy or hire a maid servant. Well, then how much more so over here, where you have you have two advantages. Number one, she can also keep house just as a maid would, and also she's his sister. So therefore, that kind of case, Rava is saying, then that's an exception to the rule that we would usually take out only from karka for her maintenance here, since she can also keep house for her brother. Then therefore that's the equivalent of, so therefore it's being done more for his sake than for hers, in other words. And therefore it can come from the Talmud as well. Okay. Continues the Gemara, Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa, Echad Nechos, more on this topic, Echad Nechosim Shiesh Lehen Achrayus, whether you're talking about Nechosim that have Achrayus, Nechosim Shiesh Lehen Achrayus is Gemara speak for land. And the idea of it is, because when you sell, well, first of all, we're going to talk about later on, where we're going to talk about further down on the Amud, the concept of achrayus, of when you sell land, there is there or isn't there an implicit achrayus in there, that if it's taken away by a creditor or whatever, that you'll reimburse them. So there is that, that's called achrayus. But also the point is that when it comes to, for example, a ksuba, or for example, a loan or anything like that, generally speaking, the shibud is only on karta, because like we talked about yesterday, karta can never be, can never disappear or be hidden or stolen or what have you. I mean, it can be stolen because somebody can take it over illegally, but it's still there. And therefore, there's more of a smichus das. There's more of a mental, of a certain mentality that no matter what, I will always be able to collect from that character, as opposed to metaltlin, or just that. They're metaltal. They're movable. So they can easily be hidden or sold or stolen or what have you. And you're not going to have them. So in the chosim sheyesh lam achrayus refers to character, and the chosim sheyin lam achrayus refers to metaltlin. So the Braisa says, Echad nechasim sheyesh lahen achrayus, whether nechasim that have achrayus, namely land, the echad nechasim she'ein lahen achrayus, or nechasim that do not have achrayus, namely metalplin, motzien lamozin isha uvonis, divrei Rebbe. Rebbe says, either way, you take from the yisaimim, from either the karka or metalplin, to support the widow, or to support the daughters. So we've been saying all this time, we've been bringing the opinions of various amiroyim that say that from Mizonis you take only from Karka, not from Metaltlin. Here we have Rebbe saying that it's both. Divrei Rebbe. Reb Shimon Alazar Omer. Reb Shimon Alazar says no. Nechasim sheyesh lahen achrayus, when it comes to Karka, sure, motzien labonos min abonim, then we take out on behalf of the girls from the boys, from their brothers, or the bonus min abonus, and also for some daughters from the other daughters, namely, let's say there are only daughters. So now the daughters are yaushining all the property. So now there's not a matter of mizonis because all the girls are equal heirs. But let's say the older girls decided, you know what, we're older, we already know how to handle things. Our little sisters are little. They're not going to know what's going on anyway. We're going to take over all the property for ourselves. So now Beis Din will go and step in and say that, no, you got to distribute it. You got to distribute it equally and you got to distribute it properly. So we'll do that. So Rabbi Shimon Elazar says, we'll do that when it's talking about, when specifically from Nechasim Sheyesh Lahem Achrayus. There's two halves of the Braisa. He's going to talk about that there are various things. This thing he's going to say you do from Nechasim Shein LaMachrayus as well. If there's only Metaltlin, or if the estate consists of both Kauka and Metaltlin, and the older girls take it all for themselves, then yeah, the same thing. Beis Din is going to step in and make sure that they redistribute it properly. But we'll get to that soon. First, he's talking about what happens with Nechasim Sheyesh LaMachrayus, property. So we do take on behalf of the girls from the boys, we take karka in order to have money in order to feed the girls. Also for the girls from the other girls, if the older girls took over the entire estate and didn't leave anything or didn't leave very much for their younger sisters. Or the bonim min abonim, the same thing for boys from boys, same idea. If you have boys who inherited and the older ones went and grabbed it all and didn't leave anything or didn't leave very much for their younger brothers, then Beis Din will step in and make sure that's done fairly. And also we'll take karka to give for the sons from the daughters, b'nechosim merubin, only if there's a lot of nechosim, avaloi, the bonim min abonis, b'nechosim mu'otim. But the boys will not get to be able to take away from the girls when it comes to nechasim muati. Namely like this, when there are boys and girls, we've talked about before, that now the boys, of course, inherit the property. The girls, meanwhile, you have the takanas hachamim, the tnai ksuba, that they're going to be supported until they become begeres, or until they get married, out of the estate. So what happens is, we've talked about previously, when there's nechasim merubin, when there's a large amount, when the estate is large, it's large enough to be able to support those girls in their accustomed style until they become begeres or they're married, and then there'll still be enough for the boys to yarishin free and clear, then we do that. That's called nechasim merubin. On the other hand, if there's nechasim muatin, would be if there's less than that. We take out what the girls need for their sustenance, for their food and whatever, until that time there won't be anything for the boys to yarishin, then we say the girls claim on that money preempts the boys, and we say that in that case, the girls will have it earmarked for them, and the boys, if there's nothing left for them, okay, they'll have to go and earn their own way, or they'll have to go and beg for tzedakah or whatever. So now, Rav Shimon Elazar is saying that there can be a case where the boys have to take away from the girls, namely where there's nechasim merubim. So suppose that there's nechasim merubim, there is in fact enough for the girls to be supported until that point. Now, let's say the girls go and take more of their estate than they're supposed to for that. So it's supposed to be, let's say, that it would cost $1 million to support the girls in that style until they become begeres or married. And let's say the estate is $2 million and the girls, let's say the girls go and take $1.5 million, which is more than what they need. So then we will take away, using karka, we'll take away from them to restore it to the boys and tell the girls, you only have the $1 million earmarked for you, which is how much you need for your mezonos. But not by nechasim muatin. If the estate was less than, when it was $1 million or less, then we're not going to do that, because then all of that is earmarked for the girls. Now, so that's so far all with karka. Continues with Shimon Elazar. Nechosim she'em la'en achrayos. What about when it comes to nechosim that have no achrayos, namely metaltalin? So then it's a little different. Motzim lebonim min abonim. Then we will take away from the boys on behalf of the other boys. Namely, again, in other words, if the older boys took more than they were supposed to of their fair shares of the estate, then basically we'll redistribute it. Or lebonis min abonis. And the same thing, if it's all girls and the older girls took more than they were supposed to, we're taking away from their younger sisters. Or lebonim min abonis. They will also be able to take away from the boy for the boys on behalf of the girls, namely again, if the girls took more than what they're supposed to for their mezonos, then Beistin will go over there and deal with that and get it redistributed properly so that the girls get the amount for their mezonos and the boys will still get their Yerusha. So therefore, so we'll do that even from the Chosim She'en Lam Achrayus, even from the Talmud. Tosfos discusses Rav Akiva Eger over here in Gilyon HaShas refers to a Tosfos later on in the Masechta that discusses that and says that there may be a difference in that regard between the Almana and the girls. The girls were saying over here, or the boys rather over here, for their Yerusha are entitled to take from both Karka and the Talplin, according to the Shimon Elazar, but maybe the Almana is different. But we'll get to that later on when we discuss that matter of the Almana later in the Masechta. Anyway, however, Rav Shimon Elazar says, Avaloy Labonis Minabonim, however, not for the girls, not on behalf of the girls from the boys, namely, as we were saying all this time, that if the girls need their mezonos, the only thing that we can validly take away from the boys, who after all are the legitimate Yoshim, the only thing we can take from them for that purpose is karka, not metalfin. So in short, in other words, he's disagreeing with Rebbe on that particular situation where it comes to supplying the zonus for the daughters. Rebbe is saying that you can take it from Karka or from Metaltlin, from the estate, and the Shimon Elazar is saying that no, only that particular thing only from Karka. And the Gemara says, Afogab the time alone, halacha ke Rebbe mechaber. Now, usually we have a rule that when we have a machlokas between Rebbe and one individual other Tana, then usually the halacha is like Rebbe. So therefore, you would think the halacha would be like Rebbe over here. But no, halacha k'rav Shimon Elazar. In this particular case, the halacha is like k'rav Shimon Elazar, and the daughters are entitled to mezonos only out of karka, not out of metalpa. And we know that, the Omar Rava, we know that because Rava said, Hilchasa, mimikauki, v'loi mimitalpli, because we just said before on the Omar, that Rava had said that the halacha is that you can only take from karka, not from the talpman, bein l'ksuba, whether we're talking about as far as ksuba, bein l'mizoni, or whether we're talking about the sustenance of the daughters, bein l'parnosa, or whether we're talking about parnosa, whether we're talking about wedding expenses and anadin, so all of those things, all of those things you can collect only from karka, not from the talpan, and therefore that's how it is. Now, we talked about yesterday, there was a takana that was made during the time of the Gaonim that said that many things that until then were collectible only from karka could be collected from the talpan, because we said there came a point in history where Jews didn't necessarily own land as a result of various Goyish policies. So therefore, in many of these things, the halacha changed, and in fact, you can collect them from the Talmudim as well. In the case of a ksuba, actually, that Amnon points out, that in a standard ksuba, you usually write, you know, you look nowadays at a standard ksuba, you usually write that the chosin has accepted on himself a shibud on everything he owns, both karka and the Talmudim. And that Amnon says, really, that's better than just relying on the sakana of the Gaonim. Because the sakana of the Gaonim, being that it's from after the time of the Gemara, a person can always claim, and based in that, I didn't know about the sakana, and therefore we can't hold him to it, and certainly we can't necessarily hold his Yoshim to it. A Yoshim actually is something else. Again, when it comes to collecting from Yoshim, it's not so simple. But anyway, when we're talking about with him, if he himself is supposed to be paying out the tzuba after he divorces his wife, he could always claim, if it was only because of the takanas of the Gaonim, that he didn't know of that takana, therefore better to write in the ksuba that he's explicitly accepting that achrayus on himself, on his karka, and on his metalplin, and then that way, like any other, tznai and ashtar, which we can hold him to. Okay. Mishnah continues, so we talked about in the previous Mishnah, we've been talking about the tznoi ksuba, the various things that a person had, that when he marries, then automatically there are certain things included in the ksuba. So actually, the previous Mishnah we talked about supporting his daughters, and we talked about the ins and outs of that. But we've been talking earlier in the perek about the various tznoi ksuba, what exactly he is, what he's entitled to from his wife, and what in return he gets from her. So we said one of the things is. So we're going to go through a couple of those things. So first of all, the Mishnah says, loy kosev laksuba, suppose that he did not write her ksuba. Now that could either be, there were places, as we're going to see later in the Masechta, there were places where to begin with they had the local minag, they don't actually write a ksuba, they just rely on the tokana of the chachamim. And then you had places where they do actually write a ksuba, as we do pretty universally nowadays, but let's say for whatever reason they didn't write one, or he wrote a lesser amount in there. Doesn't matter. Besula gober masayim ba'amana mana. Nevertheless, if she was married as a besula, then she gets 200. If she was married as an amana, then she gets 100. The pneishu tnai based in, because it's a tnai based in, and therefore she has the right to that. We learned, by the way, at the beginning of the second parak, for example, we talked about that you can have a case where we have to bring Edim, that she was a besula at the time, and we said that could be, for example, in a place where they don't write a besula, where therefore there's no, otherwise if there's a ksuba, then you just look at it and see, does it say besulta da, or does it not? But in places, for example, where they had that local minhag to not write a ksuba, or the Gemara had talked about that maybe also you could have, let's say the ksuba was destroyed, it was burnt or whatever. Anyway, the point is that then you may need edim, but so if a ksuba is written, then you just pull out the ksuba, otherwise, yeah, you need some kind of evidence that she was a besulta. Continues the Mishnah. What if he wrote her in the ksuba? He mentioned a particular field, which in fact is worth only a money, but he wrote it as if it's worth 200. So he said, I'm pledging a ksuba of 200 because she's a besula, and for and to satisfy that, I am designating a particular field of mine that is going to be used to pay the ksuba. And that field, it turns out, is worth only 100 zuz instead of 200. The loy kosev lakol nechosim deisli, and he did not write that any other nechosim, that any other real estate that I own, achroyim l'ksubasech, is under achrayus to yuksuba. So does that mean she can collect only from that one field, even though she's only collecting half of what she's supposed to? No. Nevertheless, chayev, he's still chayev to make up the rest of the 200. Again, shu tnai based in, because the tnai based in that he has to give her 200, so therefore he can't say that no, it only says in the ksuba, this one particular field, so that's all you can collect from. If it's worth less than that, tough luck. No, we say that that she's entitled to more of his property to make up the entire 200. Continues the Mishnah. Loy kosev lo. Now, we said that one of the things that a husband is obligated to do for his wife is that if she's captured by bandits or put in jail or whatever, then he has the requirement to pay money to get her out of there. And we said that that's also one of the tnoi ksuba. We said it's in return for he gets the payrus of her nechasim. Therefore, in return, he's responsible for this. So the Mishnah says, Loi Kosovla, what if he didn't write in the Ksuva the clause Im Tishtaboi, that if you are captured Efra Kinach, I will redeem you, Va'isvinach Lila into, and I will restore you to being my wife. So if he didn't write that, and the Mishnah interjects over Kehenes, what if she's a wife of a Kohen? Now, when a woman was taken captive, we've learned earlier in the Masechta, there's always the possibility that she was raped by the Goyim, who captured her. Now, if it's a Yisrael, as we're going to learn on Omud Beis, his wife remains mutter to him. But if we're talking about a Kohen, then his wife becomes also to him. So if he's a Kohen, he can't write in the Ksuba that I will redeem you and take you back as my wife, because he wouldn't be allowed to take her back as his wife. So therefore, instead, he would write, Ahadrinach Lemidinasach, instead, he would write, I will return you to your native country. So let's say she moved from a different country or a different area in order to marry him. So he's taking responsibility that he'll get her out of captivity and he'll bring her back. He'll make sure that she gets back safely to her father's house or to wherever it is, because she can't live with him anymore because he's a Kohen and she's potentially, and she's potentially been raped by the Goyim. Anyway, so if they didn't write those clauses, Chayev, he's still Chayev to do all of that. Shehu Tznai Beis Din, because again, if it's Tznai Beis Din, then he has to do that. And therefore we can't say that she was Moichel on it or anything like that. Another din. Actually, I should say a little bit differently. Most of these things that we're talking about, most of these Tznai Ksuba, a woman can be Moichel on. But if she's Moichel on them, then we need solid proof of that. It can't just be because it wasn't written in the Ksuba. It would have to be, for example, that we have Adim, that there was an actual Kenyan, or that she wrote him out a document to that effect, or something like that. Anyway, continues the Mishnah. The Im Omar, what if the husband says, Hare Gito Ksubasa, you know what? I don't want to be bothered spending my money in order to free her. Let me give her her get. At the same time, I'll give her silver money, and Batifta as Matzma, and let her free herself. Let her take some of that money that I'm paying her for silver and use that to buy her freedom. So no, Einer Ashoy, he cannot do that. Because as soon as she was taken captive, he's already chayev to free her. So therefore, he can't get out of it by divorcing her and giving her silver. Continues the Mishnah. Loksa, what if she becomes sick? Chayev la poisa, then he's, another thing he's responsible for is he has to pay her medical expenses. Before I should point out, by the way, usually the word would be cholsa, if she became sick. Loksa literally means that she was struck. And the explanation is that it means to say, if she became sick because of something that she herself did that she should have known better, then the husband's not necessarily responsible to pay for that, because that was her fault. Loksa suggests more that it happened involuntarily, so then we're saying that he's responsible for that. And Omar, what if the husband says, Hare Gito Ksubasa, same kind of thing as in previous clause in the Mishnah, where he says, you know what, I don't want to be bothered on an ongoing basis, let me divorce her, let me give her her get, and I'll give her Ksuba at the same time, to Rafe Asatma, let her pay her own medical bills. Rashoi, then he's allowed to do that, because Rashi says, after all, once he divorces her, he's not responsible for sustaining her, for giving her food anymore, and medical expenses are considered part of her sustenance, part of her mezonos. Now, with that, first of all, the question is, so why is there the difference between the shvuya and the sick woman? So the Shittim Kobetis brings from the Ramah, who explains as follows. When it comes to she's been captured by the Goyim, what would happen? All he needs to do is make them a one-time payment and she'll be free. So therefore, we require him to make that one-time payment, because at the time that she was captured, then he's chayev in that. It's one of the tenoi ksuba, and therefore he can't get out of it by divorcing her. On the other hand, when it comes to medical expenses, it's not necessarily a one-time thing. It's an ongoing thing. And therefore, at some point during that process, he has the ability to say, you know what, I want out, and let her take care of it from here on out herself, out of her own funds. The Ravid says, and then various Rishonim and Achronim quote him, that, so first of all, that Rambam says it's not right to do that. It's not derech eretz. Actually, one thing is also the Rishonim bring in this connection a Sifri, So the Sifri mentions in connection with in Parshas Kitzeitzei, you have the story of the Yifas Toyar, and the Pasuk says that if you don't want to marry the Yifas Toyar, then the Pasuk says, "Vishilachta l'nafsha." You should send her wherever she wants to go. In other words, you're not allowed to keep her as a slave woman or something. And the Sifri says, from here we see a concept that if a woman is sick, you shouldn't just divorce her, because that wouldn't be Vishilachta l'nafsha. She can't go freely wherever she wants, because after all, she's sick. So in keeping with that, the Ravid says that if the woman is very, very sick, to the extent, if we're talking about where she has some kind of thing where she can continue to function, then fine. Then we're saying over here that the husband could, in principle, divorce her and have her pay her own way from here on. But if she's what's called al eres devoy, if she's really in her sick bed and she can't get up, then the Ravid says, based on that sifri, maybe the husband would not be allowed to divorce her, because then that would go against the sishilach of anapsha. So the Noisa Kalim on Shulchan Aruch talk about that. Is that in fact the halacha, or maybe not? Maybe that sifri is only an asmachta. So whether he can do that or not is machlok when she's really sick. Is machloek as opposed to. On top of that, you have the whole question nowadays that we have cherem de'aben gershim, and the husband can't divorce his wife against her will anyway. So how does that slot into this? Does that make it, therefore, does that change it, that even if she's not al eres devoy, and where he would have the right to divorce her, is he maybe not allowed to unilaterally without her agreeing to it? Or maybe in this case, we would say that would be an exception to Cherem De'Aben Gershom. So all those things are discussed in Shulchan Aruch and the Noisa Kalim. But again, it does say it's not the Menschlicha thing to do. Okay. So the Gemara starts off. Mani. Now, who is our Mishnah like? The first part of our Mishnah says that if he didn't write a Ksuba of 200 or 100, as the case may be, then that amount is still in effect because it's Tanai based. So Mani, which Tana would our Mishnah be like? Reb Meir. Apparently, it's like Reb Meir. The Amar Kolach Peiches of the Silver and Masayim V'La Monami Mane. He says that if a husband writes or takes on himself a shibud or whatever of less than 200 for a besula or 100 for an amana, then Harezu Be'ilas Znus, then his relations with her are considered Znus. In other words, Reb Yehuda, as we're going to say in a second, says it's true that those are the amounts for the ksuba, but she has the ability to be moichel on that. She can say that I don't need full 200 or I don't need full 100. I'm willing to get married and I'm willing to stay married regardless. Our Mishnah seems to be saying, like Reb Meir though, saying that even though he didn't write 200 or even though he didn't write 100, implying that she was willing to accept less, nevertheless, we say no good. So that sounds like Reb Meir. The Eid of Yehuda. Because if we were to say our Mishnah goes like Rabbi Yehuda, Ha'omar, doesn't he say later on in the next parak, Rotza Kosev Lebsula Shtar Shemasayim, if the husband wants, he can write her out a ksuba that says Shtar Shemasayim, a ksuba that's 200, Vihi Kosevis, she can in return write a shtar that says he's Kabalti Mimcham Monen. I have received from you a monen of it. In other words, so now what would happen if later on she wants to go and collect her ksuba in Beis Din, then we'll bring out both documents and Beis Din will say the result is that she's only entitled to a mona because she's saying she's already been paid off half of it. So even though she really hasn't, she didn't receive any money from him at all, Rabbi Yehuda allows her to be moichel on that money. Similarly, v'la mona mona, similarly, Rabbi Yehuda says you can write out a ksuba of 100 for an amona, v'hi kosevis is kabaltim v'mchol chamishim zuz, and she can write him in return a document that says that I've received from you 50 zuz, and which is half of the mona. And then in that case, she'll be entitled to only 50 when she comes to collect and based it. So we see that Rabbi Yehuda allows them to make a tenai that will override the usual amounts for ksuba and reduce them below 200 or below 100. If our Mishnah is saying though that that doesn't work, and Tosfos says the implication of our Mishnah is they made an actual tenai to that effect, like the Yehuda is discussing, nevertheless, the Mishnah is saying that's no good. That tenai is invalid. Now that would have to be like Reb Meir. The problem with that is Ema Sefer. Look at the next part of the Mishnah, where we said, Kosev la Soda Shava Mona Tachas Mosayim Zuz. We said if he wrote her out he named a particular field which is really worth only a mana, tachas mosaim zuz, and really it was really it's worth only 100, but he's writing it as if it was worth 200. The loyt kosev la kol nachasim the isli achroim luksubasef, and he didn't write that all my other nachasim are achrayas yuksuba. Now, if he had written that clause, then it wouldn't really matter. Then everybody would agree that she's entitled to the full 200. Because he's saying that there's achrayus on the rest of his nechassim. So then he's meaning to say, I'm naming this particular field which is worth 100, and in addition you can take whatever other fields of mine, whatever other real estate of mine to get the other 100. But if you didn't write that point, then the Mishnah is saying, nevertheless chayav, he's still chayav to pay the full 200 shahut tnai based in, because it's a tnai based in that she's entitled to 200. Now the problem is, asan la Rabbi Yehuda. That part of the Mishnah seems to go only according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says in general, now when you sell property, usually you have the concept of achrayus. You usually have, Reuven is selling a field to Shimon, he includes, usually in the shtar, he includes a clause called achrayus, which is that, let's say, later on Levi, to whom Reuven owes money, if this Levi now comes and takes the field away from Shimon to satisfy the debt, then Reuven says, I will compensate you, Shimon, for that field that was taken away from you. So that way it gives him a certain insurance, and it gives him a certain assurance that it's safe to buy the field, and he's not going to end up losing his money. So now, what happens if in a shtar you did not write that achrayus clause? Rabbi Yehuda says it doesn't matter. It's the equivalent of as if it was written. We say achrayus tos sofahu. The fact that achrayus is missing in the shtar is just a tos sofahu. We consider it to just be a mistake by the scribe who wrote the shtar. The achrayus is still in effect. According to Rabbi Yehuda, the only way that there would be no achrayus, I'm saying it wrong, actually. The achrayus that we're talking about over here, I mean, there can be achrayus when a person sells a field, but that's something else. What we're talking about over here is achrayus as far as a loiva and a malva. So Reuven is borrowing money from Shimon, and he writes in a shtar that I owe you 100. Now, what if they didn't write in the shtar that he's taking achrayus that on his real estate to pay off this loan? So Rabbi Yehuda is saying, achrayus toros sofahu, it's considered as if it was written, and nevertheless there is still that shibud, and therefore later on Shimon will be able to go take, if Reuven afterwards goes and sells any of this property that he owned at the time to somebody else, then Shimon will be able to take it away from that someone else because he's owed that money. It didn't say achrayus in the shtar, we consider as if it was written. So Rabbi Yehuda said that. That part of our Mishnah that says, again, where the husband only wrote one field, which is worth 100, he didn't write anything about achrayus. Nevertheless, we consider that there is achrayus on the rest of his fields, and therefore she can collect 200, namely 100 from that field and 100 from someplace else. That someplace else would be, even if that other field was sold to somebody else, that would be only according to Rabbi Yehuda. After all, we find that Rav Meir holds that achrayus is not tos sofer. According to him, achrayus has to be explicitly written in the shtar. It has to be that Reuven explicitly writes to Shimon, I owe you 100, and I'm meshabed my real estate to that. And if he doesn't write it, then there's no shibud. According to Rav Meir, if in fact he only wrote a field of 100, then she's not going to be able to collect from other fields that he owned. Maybe she'd be able to collect from other fields that he owns at the time, fine, but certainly not from fields that he sold to somebody else that are in a third party's hands, she wouldn't be able to. And we know that Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda have that machlokes d'tnan. We learn in a Mishnah in Bav Metzia, Matza Shtore Choy. If a person finds loan documents. Now, the problem is, you find them in the street, you don't know, is the loan still in effect? Then in that case, then you should be returning them to the malva, so eventually you can collect with it. On the other hand, maybe the loan was already paid off, and therefore, or maybe even the Gemara talks about many possibilities over there. Maybe they wrote out the shtar intending to borrow, and they didn't yet borrow. Whatever, there can be all kinds of scenarios where then you give it to the loiva. So the question is, let's say the malva and the loiva are both coming with simonim on it. Which one do you give it to? So the Mishnah says, im yesh vahen achrayus nechassim, if there is this achrayus nechassim clause written into the document, lo yachzir, then he should not return it to either one of them. Now, let's say, for example, you could have an example where the loiva agrees. The finder comes to Beis Din. What do I do with this? The loiva and the malva both come to Beis Din. The malva says that the loan is still outstanding. Let me give you a simon. Return the shtar. You don't even need a simon, really. His name is in it. Whatever. Let me return the shtar to me. The loiva, let's say, agrees. You know what? You're right. I haven't paid off this debt yet. By all means, give it to him. Nevertheless, the Mishnah is saying, Rameir is saying, lo yachzir, he shouldn't return it. Because Beis Din will use that shtar not only to collect from the borrower himself, but to collect from third parties. If he sold property to other people, then the malveh is going to be able to take away from those other people. And the problem is that we might have a case of knunya over here. We might have that the malveh and the loiva together are colluding together to play a trick over here to defraud the third party. Let's give them names. So we have Reuven is the loiva, Shimon is the malva. So now the document was lost. So now Shimon is claiming it because I'm the malva, and Reuven is agreeing, yes, that's true, I didn't pay Shimon off yet, return it to him. The problem is, meanwhile, what will have happened since the shtar was taken out? Reuven, meanwhile, sold property to Levi. So now what's going to happen? When Shimon comes and says to Reuven, you pay up, I have the shtar, Reuven's going to say, I don't have any money. So then Shimon is going to go and find Levi, who has property that is under his shibud, that used to belong to Reuven and now was sold, and there's this lien on it. He's going to go through the whole process and base him to take it away from Levi. Meanwhile, so now Shimon gets a field that he wasn't really entitled to because maybe the debt was paid off, or maybe Reuven did have other property to satisfy the debt or whatever, and therefore they're taking away the field, they're taking it away at Levi's expense, and Reuven and Shimon can then do whatever they want with it and split their ill-gotten gains. So therefore, the mayor is saying that if you have a chrayus written in the shtar, then you can't return it under such circumstances, because there's the possibility that they can be colluding to defraud Levi. On the other hand, ein behen achrayus nechasim, but if there's no achrayus nechasim in the shtar, says Rav Meir, yachzir, then you can go ahead and return it. She'ein Beis Din nifroi mehen, give it Rav Meir. Because Rav Meir says anyway, Beis Din is not going to be able to collect from a third party with such a shtar. No achrayus means that Shimon is going to be able to collect only from whatever property Reuven owns right now, not from any property that he sold. Therefore, there's no possibility of defrauding anybody else. That's what Rameh says. The Chachamim say, and Rashi points out that the Chachamim over here necessarily includes Rabbi Yehuda, because the Chachamim means the other Chachamim of Rameh's generation, which includes Rabbi Yehuda. And in fact, in general, when we have a machlokes with Rameh, it's usually Rabbi Yehuda who's arguing with him. So he says, and all the other Chachamim say, Echad zeva echad zelo yachzer. Either way, whether Achrayus is written in the shtar or not, either way, you don't return it. Based in Nifroin Mehen, because either way, based in, even if Achrayus is not written, again, we say Achrayus Tor Sefer, we consider that that even if Achrayus is not written, it's as if it was written, and therefore Shimon has every right to take away property not only from Reuven himself, but from anybody that Reuven sold property to after the loan was taken out, after the shtar was written, and therefore even if no Achrayus is written, then you have this possibility of Knunia. So again, our Mishnah seems to be going like Rabbi Yehuda in that regard, because our Mishnah is saying, even though the husband did not write out fields that are worth full 200, he wrote only one that's worth 100, nevertheless, she has the right, when she's collecting huksuva, to collect full 200, and that means even from Nechasim Meshavadim. So that would be like Rabbi Yehuda. But we said that the first part of the Mishnah, where he has to do 200 or 100 regardless, and she can't be moichel on any of it, is according to the mayor. So what's going on? Reisha the mayor is safer than Yehuda. Do we have a Mishnah over here where the first half is like the mayor and the second half is like Rabbi Yehuda? We don't usually have that. So you might answer, no, the whole Mishnah could be made to work according to the mayor. The shiny later the mayor being sub of the story. You could argue that maybe the mayor would hold that there's a distinction between a ksuba and other shtaris. Maybe the mayor would say, true, when it comes to IOUs and other such documents, then we wouldn't say achrayus toa sefer. If it doesn't say achrayus, then achrayus is not in effect. But a ksuba, the mayor maybe would say that achrayus is in effect no matter what, and we always consider the lack of it to be toa sefer. But the problem is, me, shiny lay, is that in fact the case? Does the mayor in fact hold that there is such a distinction? But Hatanya, we learn in a braisa, Chamisha Goven Minam Churorin. There are five cases where people can collect only from Nechosim B'nei Chorin. They cannot collect from Nechosim B'Shabbatim. Nechosim B'nei Chorin would be property, would be real estate that's still owned by the person who owes the money. So in our scenario before, for example, where Shimon lent Reuven money, then any property that Reuven still owns at the time when Shimon is coming to collect the debt is called Nechosim B'nei Chorin. Anything else that Reuven sold and is now being collected as a result of the lien is Nechosim B'Shabbatim. So the Braith says there are five situations where you can collect only from Nechosim B'nei Chorin. The Elohim, number one, Peiros. Number one and number two, Peiros or Shvach Peiros. Number one, produce and the improvement that was made having to do with the Peiros. Namely, so you have like this. Let's say, for example, that Reuven stole a field from Shimon, and then Reuven took that field and sold it to Levi. Now, if it was so far, we would just say eventually when Shimon comes to Beis Din, then sure, as long as he brings proof that the field is his, then he takes it away from Levi, and that's that. And then it's Reuven, and then it's Levi's business to go and deal with Reuven and get reimbursed for the fact that he was sold a stolen field. Now, the twist is, though, that what if while during the time when Levi was in possession of this property, what if he improved it? What if he did things to it to improve the value of it, or you have this produce growing in there and the produce is worth money? What do we do as far as that? So Shimon, the original owner of the field, is going to get everything back. But meanwhile, Levi is going to be going to Reuven and saying, one second, you sold me a stolen field, pay up. Now, what is he going to be entitled? Now, when it comes to the actual value of the field itself, the actual purchase price, that he can collect even from Reuven's Nechosim B'Shabbatim. Because it's a known amount how much that was. When people sell a field, there's usually a coil so people know. So the idea is, that in general, the idea is, when you're able to collect from Nechosim B'Shabbatim, it's because the buyer himself should have realized that the third party should realize that, you know what, there is the possibility that there is a lien on this. I know that this person has an outstanding ksuba of X amount. I know that he has outstanding loans of X amount, etc. And therefore, when I'm buying this field, I'm taking that risk that if he can't pay those X amounts, then they may take away this field from me, and then I'm going to have to go seek recourse. But when it comes to, so that works for things where the value is known. You know how much the loan is, you know how much the tsuba is, etc. But for example, Peiros is going to be variable. Shvach is going to be variable. If we're going to allow in our scenario over here, again, Levi has had the field taken away from him by Shimon because Shimon was the original rightful owner and Levi bought stolen property from Reuven. But meanwhile, Levi has improved the field. So now Levi goes back to Reuven to demand reimbursement. The value of the field itself, he can collect not only from Reuven's B'nei Chorin, but even from Nechosim B'Shabbatim, meaning that if meanwhile Reuven had sold some real estate of his, Reuven the Gazlan had sold some real estate of his previously to Yehuda, then Levi would be entitled to go to Yehuda and demand that he give him a field to compensate him for that. But when it comes to the value of the payers, so the value of the Shrach, then we don't say that. Then he's only entitled to collect from Reuven's Nechosim B'nei Chorin, not from Nechosim B'Shabbatim. And this is an example of Tikkun HaOlam, because otherwise nobody would ever buy any fields, because they'd always think there's always a possibility that it might be taken away as a result of amounts that I don't even have a way of knowing how much they might. So those are the first two. Peiros means the actual peiros themselves. Shvach peiros means the various improvements in the field. For example, if the guy plowed it carefully so it'll produce a better crop or whatever, things like that. So those two, he collects only from the Peiros and the Shvach Peiros, he collects only from the Chosim B'nei Chorin. The third one is, V'amakabal olav lozunas ben ishtoy uvas ishtoy. What if a man is marrying, his wife has children from a previous marriage, and so when he marries her, he makes a deal with her that he's going to continue supporting her children. These are his stepchildren, they're not biologically related to him, but he promises to support them. Now again, that's not a fixed amount, because you never know how much mazonis might be over the years. Same thing, they can collect for that only from the Chosim B'nei Chorin, only from the husband's property that he owns at the time, not from real estate that he sold to somebody else. Same idea, because it's not a fixed amount, and you can't expect the buyers to know that. Rashi, by the way, mentions that later on in the Masechta, we do have an example where they can be supported from the Chosim B'Shabadim, but that's talking about where there was a Kinyan involved, and a Kinyan, they already write out a Shtar for that, and once there's a Shtar, then already it's a known thing that this exists. So, whereas here in the Gemara, we're talking about more than it was a verbal agreement. Next, the get choiv she'en v'achrayus. The next one is a get, is another word for a shtar. So a shtar choiv, in which there's not achrayus. So like we said before, the achrayus clause was not written in there. So Ruvain, the borrower, was saying to Shimon the Malva, I owe you X amount, but he didn't write in there anything about, but if I can't pay it, then you can take from any, then I'm mortgaging all my property for it. So that would be the fourth one then. So then there's no achrayus, so therefore you can't take from the chosim shabadim. And the fifth one is a ksubas isha shein v'achrayus, where a ksuba doesn't have achrayus written in it. Now, man shamat le d'om achrayus lav toris soifahu. Now, the fourth example is a shtar chov, and which tana is it that says that if it doesn't say achrayus in that shtar chov, then it doesn't count. We don't, we say there's no achrayus. That would be Rav Meir. That was Rav Meir who said before, said that, whereas Rav Yehuda would say that not. Vikatonic ksubas isha. And still, we're mentioning this braisa, the fifth item was a ksuba that doesn't have achrayus is the same thing. So we see that Rameyu does not draw a distinction between a ksuba or any other shtar chayv. So we're back to, therefore, so when our Mishnah is implying that achrayus is in effect, even if it's not written, that could only, when in a ksuba, that could go only like Rabbi Yehuda. The problem is, we said that the first part of our Mishnah goes like Rameyu. So the answer is, the Gemara says no. Iboris emir of Meir, Iboris emir of Yehuda. You could actually say that the whole Mishnah goes like Rav Meir, or you could say that the whole Mishnah goes like Rav Yehuda. Iboris emir of Yehuda. First, let's deal with how it could be according to Rav Yehuda. Hotam kosvalei skabalti, because in Rav Yehuda's scenario, where he says, so what happens? The husband writes out a ksuba of 200, for example. She, in return, writes out a shtar saying, I received 100. So therefore, Rav Yehuda says that we can accept that and say that therefore it means that she was moichel on 100. Whereas in our Mishnah, hocha le kosvalei skabalti, in our Mishnah, she didn't write any such thing. So therefore, the point of our Mishnah was, even though no ksuba was written, we don't say that she was moichel on anything. It's one thing if we have a document in our hand showing that she was moichel, then sure. But otherwise, if no ksuba is written, okay, then we rely orally on the takonis chachamim. The takonis chachamim is that it's 200, and therefore we don't say that she was moichel. And the same thing, the Maharam Sheikh points out, in the second part of the Mishnah, same idea, when we don't say that she willingly accepted, okay, this field is worth only 100, I'm willing that this is only, the only one that's mortgaged for this purpose. No, we're gonna say that he misled her, he made her think that it's only, that it's worth 200, when really it's only worth 100, she wasn't moichel on anything, therefore she's entitled to the full 200. So the whole Mishnah could work like Rabbi Yehuda. Or you could say that the whole Mishnah goes like a mayor, because you could say my chayev katani, because when our Mishnah says that he's chayev to pay, doesn't mean from the, just means minam choradin, just means from the chosid b'nei choradin, doesn't mean, it would mean, in other words, so in this case, in the second part of the Mishnah, where he wrote out a shtar, he mentioned a particular field which is worth only 100, so yeah, she's entitled to her full 200. But the remaining 100, she won't be able to collect from the Shabbadim, Rav Meir would say, because he would say achrayus, there's no achrayus over there. So therefore he would say, fine, she can collect from his nechosim b'nei choradin. She can collect from any other fields that he still owns at the time that the tzuba is being paid off. So it wouldn't necessarily, we assume to begin with that when it says chayev, means he's chayev even from the chosim b'shabodim, but not necessarily the Mishnah could mean from the chosim b'necha. Okay. The Mishnah had said loy tosav lafola, so we said if he didn't write out for her the clause in the ksuba that says that if she's captured, then he's going to free her from captivity, and either if he's Yisrael, continue living as husband and wife, or if he's a Kohen, where they're not allowed to do that, then he'll return her to her house, then nevertheless, he's on the hook for that, because it's Sinai based. So let's talk about that matter, let's talk about that point, that a Yisrael's wife, who was raped, on Mishnah, seems to be saying that she's mutter to her husband. So now, we know a basic concept, that when it comes to, if it was willing, if it was not rape, if it was consensual, then whether he's a Yisrael or whether he's a Kohen, either way she becomes osur to him. Only if it was against her will, only then do we say that there's that distinction. So the Gemara says, Amar Avuah de Shmuel, so Shmuel's father says, Ashes Yisraelson Shenanza Asura Levaila, a wife of a Yisrael who was raped, becomes also to her husband. And we're, now we're going to ask soon, what do we mean? We said that she's mutter, but first, the problem is, Avur Deshmol says, Chayshinan, we have to be concerned, Shemet Chilosa Ba'onis V'Sofa Baratzen. At the beginning, yeah, it was an onus. She was forced into it. But maybe by the end, maybe she was already consenting to it. So if it was consensual, she'd be asur. And in fact, Tosfos says, that Avur Deshmol, when he says Chayshinan, is not even Midrabanan, it means Midaraisa. We'd have to be concerned about that. So the Gemara is going to explain soon what Avur Deshmol would say. So what is the case where an Eishes Yisrael was raped and she's still mutter to her husband? We'll talk about that in a couple of lines. Tosfos also mentions, by the way, what about Esther? We have the famous case of Esther, where she was taken to Ahasuerus's palace. She was already married to Mordechai, and she still remained mutter to Mordechai. Until Hasher of Adzi of Adzi, at least. So how is that? According to Avur Deshmol, how would that work? And the answer is Tosfos says, listen, she was a tzadikas gemura. There's no question that there was no point in her relationship with Ahasuerus where it would be consensual. And therefore, even Avur Deshmol would agree, as the gemara is going to say soon, where we know for a fact, where we can show that it was not consensual from beginning to end, then as the gemara is going to say soon, Avur Deshmol would agree that she's mutter. So the Gemara says, Eisvei Rav La'avur Deshmol. So Rav pointed out a contradiction to Avur Deshmol from our Mishnah. We said, Im Tishtabori, the husband writes out for his wife in the Ksuba, or again, even if he didn't write it out, then the Tanai is still in effect. If you are captured, Efrikinach, I will redeem you from captivity. For Isvinach Lila Intu, and I will restore you to myself as my wife. If he's Yisrael. So we see that even though she was taken captive, and the whole problem is that she may have been raped by them, nevertheless, she's still mutter to him. According to you, Avur Deshmol, how would that work out? Isn't there the possibility that she eventually ended up making peace with the situation and agreeing to it? So the Gemara says, Ishtik, Avur Deshmol was quiet. He didn't give an answer. Kori Rav Alei Deshmol, Alei Da Avur Deshmol. So Rav applied to Avur Deshmol, the pasuk, and it says, Sorim Otsru B'milim, princes have stopped their words, V'chaf Yasimu L'fihem, and they put their hand to their mouth. In other words, in context, this is in Sefer Iyov, where after Iyov's friends have been debating with him for 30 or so chapters, then they finally quiet down. They have no answer, and Elihu then speaks up to talk to Iyov, and he's saying, I'm very surprised that like these princes, these noble people who have so much to say, all of a sudden they're quiet and they don't have an answer. So Rav is saying the same thing on Avur Deshmol, such a Talmid Chacham, it's odd that he doesn't have anything to answer. So the Gemara says, "My Islam name." What could Avur Deshmol have answered? He could have answered the Shvuya Hekilu. He could have answered that with a Shvuya, with a woman who was taken captive, there were Mekel. Because after all, it's not that we saw that she was raped. We just know that there's a high likelihood of it. So really, what we have there is a Spek Sveka, a suffix whether she was even raped by them anyway. And even if she was it completely Ba'onis or was it partially at the end Baratzen? So therefore, Avur Deshmol could say that there we would say that she's mutter to her husband if he's Yisrael. But in a case where we know that she was raped, and the only question is whether it was entirely Ba'onis or whether at some point it was Baratzen, then Avur Deshmol could say that might be different. Well, the question is, well, according to Avur Deshmol, what is the scenario where the Torah tells us, as we're going to learn in a little bit, that a woman who was, that a wife of a Yisrael who was Nanas is mutter to him? According to Avur Deshmol, don't we have, we say we always have to be choshesh? That maybe not. And the answer is, let's say Adam see that she was screaming and then trying to avoid it from beginning to end. So then it's clear that from beginning to end, it was Onus, and then Avur Deshmol would agree that she's mutter to her husband, unless he's a kohen. However, the Gemara says, all of this will pliga de Rava. This statement of Avur Deshmol disagrees with Rava. The Amar Rava calls you to philosopher Onus for Seif Baratzen. It doesn't matter. As long as the beginning was Ba'onus, even if the end of it was Baratzen, and then she's still mutter. And Rava says, Afilu hi ayimeres. Even if the woman herself, so let's say you have people are coming to help her and kill the guy, which the halacha is that if the halacha is if a roedif is pursuing somebody with intent to kill or with intent to commit alias, then you try to wound him if you can in order to stop him, and if wounding is not going to help, or if you're too far away to get a clear shot, then you're allowed to actually kill him. So afilu he emeres, even if she says to them, hanichuloi, leave him alone. I want this. Even if, you know what, if he hadn't come and started this and then gotten involved with me, he sechauto, she, meaning I, would have hired him. In other words, she has such a taiva right now that she's saying that I would have actually hired this guy to do this to me, to have relations with me. So it sounds like it's berotzen. But since it started ba'onis, muteres, she remains muter to her husband. My time a yetzer albasha, because at that point she's clothed with the yetzer. In other words, the nature is that once bia has started, then she has a taiva for it, or her taiva gets aroused, and it's very hard to quench. So yeah, as long as it started ba'onis, even if afterwards it becomes beratzen, nevertheless the fact that it was ba'onis at the beginning she remains mutter to her husband. So not like Avor Shmuel says that we would have to know, that we would have to see that she was screaming about it and then trying to resist from beginning to end. And the Gemara says, Tanya Kavasei de Rava. In fact, we learn a Braisa like what Rava says. The Pasuk says, V'hi lo nispos. B'chlau, where do we know that a woman who was raped remains mutter to her husband unless he's a Kohen? So the Pasuk says, in connection with a Sota, it describes where, so we have reason to think that she may have had relations with somebody else. V'hi lo nispos. She was not grabbed. In other words, it wasn't by force. And the Pasuk is saying, Asura. In that case, she'd be also to her husband. If we know that it was consensual, ha nisposa muteris, implying that if she was grabbed, if she was forced, then she remains muter to her husband. And the braisa continues, v'yesh l'cha acheres. Now you have another case, she'afa pishal nisposa, even though she's not been grabbed, even though it's not by force, muteris, she's still muter to her husband. V'ezuzu, what is that case? Kol shetchilas ba'onis v'soifa beratzin. If the beginning was ba'onis, even though the end was beratzin. So even though the end, at the end of it, during the end of the act, or later on during the act, it's no longer ba'onis. So at that point, the hilo nispasa, at that point she could push him away and be able to get away and be safe. Nevertheless, we don't expect her to do that, and we still consider her to be an anusa, and we don't hold her responsible, and we don't make her also to her husband. So that would be like Rava, and that's the halacha. However, the Gemara says, Tanya Idach, we do have a different braisa to support Avor Shmuel, which says, again, basing on the same pasuk, Vihila Nisposa Asura, the pasuk is saying that if she wasn't grabbed, if she wasn't forced, she's Asur, implying Ha Nisposa Muteres, implying that if she was forced, then she's Muter. V'yesh L'cha Acheres She'af B'shin Nisposa Asura. On the other hand, the pasuk is telling you the contrast. There was a different case. Even though she was grabbed, even though she was forced, she's still also the Ezuzu. And what is that case? Eshes Koyen, the wife of a Koyen. Where there she's also, even though it was Ba'onis. So that Braisa does not distinguish between whether it was the entire thing Ba'onis, or the beginning Ba'onis, and the end Baratzen. That would fit with Avor Shmuel. But Rava has a Braisa supporting him as well. And the halacha is like Rava. So as long as the beginning was Ba'onis, then we're not concerned with what happens after that, even though it sounds like at that point she's berotzen, because at that point it's not really her full rotzen, it's really at that point the yetzer within her that's speaking. Since we're mentioning that pasuk, and we're saying that there can be a case where a woman, the hilo nisposa, is mutter, so the Gemara mentions, by the way, Amar of Yehuda Amashmol, Mishrom Abishmol, here's another thing that we learn from that. The hilo nisposa asura, the pasuk is saying if she wasn't grabbed, if she wasn't forced, then she's also to her husband. Ha nisposa muteres, implying that if she was, then she's mutter. But the yesh la acheres, there is another case, she'af bishlo nisposa muteres, where even though she was not forced, she's still mutter, but here we mean not mutter to her husband, but mutter to others. The Ezu, what is that case? Zu kishu kiddushah, kiddushah tos. What if the kiddushin took place betos? So let's say, for example, there was a tnai on the kiddushin, and the tnai didn't end up getting fulfilled. So then she's not considered married to her husband because the kiddushin are invalid. So then, even if she has her child riding on her shoulders, in other words, she's not only had relations with somebody else, but she even had a child with him, she doesn't need anything. All she needs is to refuse, and not even really, we don't mean the miyun of the kind that we talk about in Yavamas. We're not talking about she's a katana. We just mean, in other words, that her kiddushin, her original kiddushin, are not in effect. They're dissolved because they were never in effect in the first place. And she can go her way, and what she did is not considered that she was an Eishes Ishu was Mizana, because the Kiddushin to begin with were Betos. So that also the Pasuk is implying by this word, Vehi Lo Nisposa. Okay, continuing on this matter of women who were captured by Goyim. So Omer of Yehuda, Hani Noshi de Ganvu Ganvi, women who were captured by thieves, Sharian Megubrayhu, they remain mutter to their husbands if their husbands are Yisrael. Because again, even if the goyim had relations with them, we assume that it was by force, because it was ba'onis. Amri le rabbanim le Rabbi Yehuda, but the other chachamim ask Rabbi Yehuda, v'hokam amtien lehu nama. Don't we see that these women, while they're in captivity among these thieves, they bring them bread, they bring them food? Doesn't that show that at this point it's already berotzen? And the answer is no. Machmas Yira, they're doing it out of fear because they're afraid if they don't supply food to them, then they're afraid that the ganovim will kill them. So it's still considered bonus. What about Bahakam Shalfim Lahugiri? But they say sometimes we even see that these women will supply arrows to them. So let's say when there's a shootout going on, so you have the listim over there are shooting, and they're the law enforcement or other people who are trying to save the women or whatever are going to be shooting back, and the women sit over there next to these ganovim, and they hand them arrows. In other words, like they're helping them out to defend them. Now, why would they be doing that? Wouldn't they rather that the ganovim be killed and then they're free to go? Doesn't that show that at this point it's not onus anymore? And again, the answer is machmas yira. It can still be machmas yira because, as the Shittim Kovetzis explains, the women are afraid if we don't do that, if we don't sit there and give them their arrows to allow them to continue shooting, then they're going to kill us. They're going to say that they're going to say that we're a liability to them, that we're and they're going to kill us. So therefore, they're still doing it out of fear. But the Gemara says, "Vade shavkinu va'ozlan minafshayu." But definitely, if the ganovim leave these women alone, they allow them to go free, and the women return to the ganovim, then definitely asira. And then there's no question. They're also, because then at that point, there's obviously no yira going on. Then it's obviously that they're going back to them berotzen, and therefore they become also to their husbands. Another thing in this connection, Tanan Abanan, Shvuye Malchus Harein Kishvuyin, people who are captured by the government, for example, Rashi says, when the king takes women for Tashmish, as the Gemara is going to say in a second, like we find with Achashverosh in the Megillah. So then Harein Kishvuyin, so then they're considered like captives. And the captives doesn't just mean like they're taken prisoners of war or something. It means, for example, any time that they're being forced to be, they're taken by the king for the purpose of he wants them for his harem. So that's considered like Shvuyin. Gnuve listus ainen kishvuyin. On the other hand, when women are being captured by regular robbers, then they're not considered like shvuyin, because then they're not in such danger. So then they become also to their husbands. So the Gemara says, "Valtanya itpa." Don't we have a brayse that says the other way around, that if they were taken by the king, then it's considered consensual and they're also to their husbands. But if they were taken by listim, then it's considered oynes and they're mutter. And the answer is, so the Gemara says, Malchus and Malchus like Kasha. When it comes to the two brises talking about kingdoms, there's no Kasha. Hova Malchus Achashverosh, Hova Malchus Ben Netzer. Because there's a difference between the kingdom of Achashverosh versus the kingdom of Ben Netzer. Ben Netzer was a famous bandit chief in those times who actually got to the point of even capturing cities. Your average bandit over there would just have some area, some tiny area that he would have dominion over. Here, this Ben Netzer was actually more powerful and he captured entire cities. Historically, there was someone named Jewish history, Papa Ben Netzer, who at one point captured parts of Babel and in particular destroyed the city of Nahda. He may be the one that's referred to over here. There are some Mephoshim that associate Ben Netzer actually with Nebuchadnezzar and say that it's certainly not Nebuchadnezzar himself based on the context of the Gemara, but maybe he's a descendant of his or something. Anyway, so Achashverosh versus Ben Netzer, Achashverosh is considered a legitimate kingship. Because after all, a woman knows when she's taken like that, it's very unlikely that he's going to actually marry her. Most likely, he's just going to be ma'anis her, therefore it's considered onus. As opposed to Ben Netzer, he's a bandit chief. He needs a queen of the bandits. So therefore, so maybe she's thinking that he might be willing. If I act in a way that he likes, then maybe he'll actually marry me and make me his, and then make me his wife. So therefore, it could be more barat. Listus, like Kasha, and when it comes to the different kinds of bandits, there's no Kasha, Hub Ben Netzer, Hub Listim Da'alma, because you have Ben Netzer, Bruce. consider him, are we considering him a king, or are we considering him a listim? And the two halves, we seem to be, first we're calling him a melech, just not as great as Ahasuerush, and then we're calling him a listim, and greater than regular listim. And Gemara says, that's exactly it. Ain, Lagabe Ahasuerush, relative to Ahasuerush, or some other powerful king or emperor like that listim, who relative to that, Ben Netzer, with all the fact that he controls entire cities, he's still only a listim. Gabi listim the Alma, but relative to a regular listim melechu, then he really has the status of a king compared to the average listim. There is, in fact, an explanation also. Why is the Gemara mentioning Ahasuerush? Couldn't have mentioned any other king in history. And the idea is, and why Ben Netzer particularly, and the idea is, Ahasuerush, we know, was himself very much into tivus with women. We have the whole thing in the Megillah. On the other hand, Nebuchadnezzar not only was not, but we actually find a medrash where when his soldiers came and conquered Eretz Yisrael, he gave them specific instructions not to get involved with married women. He knew that Hashem hates Znus, and he knew that he and his soldiers could be in trouble if they did that. So therefore, the Gemara is making a similar distinction. Ahasuerush himself is very much into women. He doesn't care if people do the same thing in his kingdom. Therefore, you can say that a woman who's captured by him and taken to his harem is ba'oines. On the other hand, when it comes to Ben Netzer, who's more chaste about these kinds of things, he follows his ancestor Nebuchadnezzar in that, then there's more of a reason to think the woman could easily get away. She could always claim, I'm a married woman, and he would leave her alone, just as Nebuchadnezzar did, and therefore if she didn't, then there's more reason to call it that was Beratzen.
Why was that considered a